Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Just now they bombed the house from the morning, bombing, shooting, bulldozer destroyed the streets, destroyed anything comes in their faces, cars being burned, the Freedom Theater being attacked.
The Jenin refugee camp is reeling after Israel carries out its largest military operation in the occupied West Bank in over 20 years. We'll get an update from inside the camp, then to France, where thousands have been arrested in a week of nationwide protests after video captured the police killing of Nahel Merzouk, a 17-year-old teenager of Algerian Moroccan descent during a traffic stop in a Paris suburb.
Imagine if that had been my brother, my little or my big brother, in the street because we refused to comply. I mean, we are not safe here. We should be safe with the police, but we are scared of them. That is not normal.
Then, as the Supreme Court blocks Biden's student debt relief plan, we'll talk with the debt collective's Astra Taylor about what's next.
We are not going to let the Supreme Court have the last word. Thanks to grassroots organizing and public pressure, President Biden announced within hours of the decision that he is going to pursue another legal pathway, the Higher Education Act, to cancel student debt.
And as the Supreme Court allows a wedding website designer to turn away same-sex couples, we'll speak to the head of the Interfaith Alliance, who says religion is not a license to discriminate. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel says it's withdrawn from the occupied West Bank city of Jenin following a brutal two-day raid that killed at least 12 Palestinians in Jenin and one in Ramallah. Scores more were injured. It was the worst Israeli attack on the West Bank in 20 years. Thousands are taking part in a funeral procession today for the victims. Jenin's mayor lamented the UN has, quote, failed us and accused Israel of war crimes. The raid came after over a year of deadly Israeli military attacks. This is an injured elderly resident of Jenin speaking while the assault was still ongoing.
They are attacking unarmed people. They use planes and rockets. This is not supposed to happen in the camp. Nothing is safe in the camp. They dug up the camp with bulldozers. Why? What did the camp do?
Meanwhile, Israel launched airstrikes on Gaza earlier today in response to rocket fire from the besieged enclave. On Tuesday, Israel's far-right national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, called on civilians to carry guns after a car ramming and stabbing attack in Tel Aviv claimed by Hamas. At least 8 people were wounded. On Sunday, Israel announced it's buying an additional 25 F-35 Lockheed Martin stealth fighter jets from the United States, bringing its arsenal to 75 jets. The deal is financed through U.S. military aid to Israel. France remains roiled by nationwide protests following the police killing last week of Nahel Merzouk, a 17-year-old teenager of North African descent. Some 3,400 people have been arrested in recent days as tens of thousands of police descended on French streets. Thousands of vehicles have been burned and homes and businesses damaged. Prosecutors are investigating the death of a 27-year-old who was hit by a projectile, likely fired by riot police during street clashes. The killing of Merzouk has thrust long simmering tensions around racism and the French police into the spotlight.
Imagine if that had been my brother, my little or my big brother, in the street because we refused to comply. I mean, we are not safe here. We should be safe with the police, but we are scared of them. That is not normal.
We'll go to France for the latest later in the broadcast. In Ukraine, at least 43 people, including 12 children, were injured in a Russian attack in the northeastern Kharkiv region today. Russia's accused Ukraine, aided by the U.S. and NATO, of launching a drone attack on Moscow, leading to the temporary closure of an international airport Tuesday. Kyiv has not claimed responsibility for the attack. Meanwhile, Ukraine has been holding emergency drills after warning Russia may blow up the Zaporizhia nuclear plant, the largest nuclear plant in Europe. On Saturday, the Ukrainian writer Victoria Amelina died as a result of injuries from a Russian strike on a restaurant in Kramatorsk last week, which killed 13 people. Amelina was part of a human rights group, Truth Hounds, investigating Russian war crimes. She was at a restaurant meeting with a Colombian delegation. She was remembered by her peers during a funeral service in Kyiv Tuesday.
It was important to her to travel to the deoccupied areas and gather testimonies about Russia's crimes and tell the world about it as much as she can. We did not only lose a writer and poet in her prime, but also a human rights defender, an honest and shining voice on the international stage.
This comes as prominent Russian journalist Elena Milishina was violently attacked, along with attorney Alexander Nemov, while on their way to the court sentencing of a human rights activist in Grozny, Chechnya's capital. Unknown assailants beat them, shaved off Milishina's hair, and doused her in blue paint. She reports for the Novaya Gazeta, described the harrowing attack from the hospital where she was being treated.
It was like a classic kidnap, like the ones they used to do. It just hasn't happened in a long time. They came, threw the taxi driver out of the car. They got in, put my head down and tied my hands. They put me on my knees and a pistol to my head.
Elena Milishina was reporting in Chechnya on the LGBTQ community. Back in the United States, the Supreme Court on Friday blocked President Biden's student debt relief plan, which sought to cancel up to $20,000 in individual loans, adding up to over $400 billion of federal student debt. The 6-3 decision by the ultra-conservative-led court came as a major blow to some 40 million qualified borrowers. President Biden announced his administration would pursue a new path for debt relief.
The so-called Higher Education Act. That will allow Secretary Cardona, who's with me today, to compromise, waive, or release loans under certain circumstances. This new path is legally sound. It's going to take longer, but in my view, it's the best path that remains to providing for as many borrowers as possible with debt relief.
Meanwhile, three civil rights groups filed a complaint against Harvard with the Department of Education, arguing Harvard's legacy admissions policy discriminates against applicants of color. After the Supreme Court ruled last week, colleges cannot use affirmative action in their admissions. 70% of legacy students at Harvard are white, and candidates with family ties are more than five times as likely to be admitted than non-legacy applicants. In another setback for equal rights, the Supreme Court also ruled Friday in favor of a Christian Colorado web designer who refused to create websites for same-sex couples, even though the state bans such discrimination. The justices were again divided 6-3 along ideological lines. Liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote in the dissent, the decision was heartbreaking and a, quote, reactionary exclusion, unquote. Following Friday's rulings, California Congressmember O'Connor and other Democrats reintroduced a bill imposing an 18-year term limit on Supreme Court justices and giving presidents two appointments during a White House term. President Biden last week said the current Supreme Court is, quote, not a normal court, but rejected calls to expand it. We'll have more on the latest Supreme Court rulings later in the broadcast. It was another deadly Independence Day weekend as at least 15 people were killed in a spate of shootings across the U.S. In Philadelphia, an AR-15 toting gunman in a bulletproof vest shot and killed five people and injured two boys in an apparently random mass shooting Monday. In Fort Worth, Texas, an armed attack following Independence Day festivities claimed another three lives. These came after two people were killed and at least 28 injured, including many children, by gunfire at a Baltimore block party. At least five people were shot dead across Chicago over the holiday weekend. During a speech at the National Education Association Tuesday, President Biden again called on Congress to pass stricter gun control legislation.
Arming teachers is not the answer. Arming teachers is not the answer. Banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, extensive background checks, they're part of the answer.
A federal judge has blocked parts of Florida's new election law, including a provision barring non-U.S. citizens and people convicted of certain felonies from collecting or handling voter registration materials. U.S. District Judge Mark Walker slammed the law as, quote, Florida's latest assault on the right to vote. Tuesday, July 4th, was the hottest day ever recorded around the world, with the average global temperature reaching 62.92 degrees Fahrenheit, according to data from the U.S. National Centers for Environmental Prediction. The previous record of 62.62 degrees was reached one day earlier, Monday, as heat waves scorched multiple regions across the globe. Here in the U.S., millions of people have been under excessive heat warnings in the south and west of the country. Meanwhile, wildfire smoke from Canada continues to plague large sections of the United States. Wildfires are also burning in Colorado and Washington state. The International Atomic Energy Agency has approved Japan's plan to dump over 1 million metric tons of treated radioactive water from the Fukushima nuclear power plant into the Pacific Ocean. The water has been in storage following the 2011 tsunami and nuclear disaster there. This is IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi.
It's not the IAEA decision. It's a decision by the government of Japan. If the government decides to proceed with it, the IAEA will be permanently here, reviewing, monitoring, assessing this activity for decades to come.
The plan has drawn ire from China and South Korea, as well as smaller Pacific Island nations, environmentalists, and a large section of people in Japan. The treated water still contains tritium, a byproduct of nuclear fission, which has been linked to cancer. The UN Security Council voted to end its decades-long peacekeeping presence in Mali after Mali's military junta told the 13,000-troop international force to leave. Mali suffered deadly attacks from armed rebel groups across its north and central regions following an uprising in 2012. The security crisis has led to back-to-back coups in 2020 and 2021. In addition to the UN forces, an estimated 1,000 fighters from Russia's Wagner mercenary group remain in Mali. Earlier this year, a UN report found Wagner soldiers took part in an attack on the village of Mora last year, which killed 500 people, mostly civilian. Guatemala has begun a review of its ballots from its presidential election after the party of frontrunner, former First Lady Sandra Torres, and her allies challenged the results of June's first round. Protests erupted in Guatemala City over the weekend after the Constitutional Court suspended the certification of the results, which put the progressive candidate Bernardo Arevalo of the Semilla Party in second place, sending him to the runoff in August against Sandra Torres. Rights groups have urged the court to respect the will of millions of Guatemalans who took to the polls last month. This is a Semilla attorney.
What is clear is that the slogan of the official party, supported by parties close to the ruling party, is to manage to open as many boxes as possible that will allow them to declare the electoral process null and void so that the election can be repeated.
Bernardo Arevalo is the son of the first democratically elected president of Guatemala, Juan José Arevalo, who pushed for revolutionary social reforms when he was in office from 1945 to 51. And in Brazil, former far-right president Jair Bolsonaro has been banned from running for public office until 2030. Brazil's electoral court found Bolsonaro guilty of abuse of power and fueling disinformation in last year's presidential election, which he lost to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Warren and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Palestinians in the Jenin refugee camp are facing widespread destruction after Israel withdrew troops today following what some are calling the largest military operation in the occupied West Bank in 20 years. The Jenin refugee camp is home to around 11,000 people. Israel attacked what it said were militants in the camp with drone-fired missiles and ground troops. Palestinian health officials say the massive two-day military assault killed 12 Palestinians, injured at least 140 more. The head of Jenin Hospital reports most of the wounded were shot in the head and chest. The Israeli military claimed it was targeting militants, but residents of the camp say they were targeted by airstrikes and nonstop ground fire. Israeli bulldozers destroyed roads out of the camp and left just a single road for ambulances to evacuate the wounded. Doctors Without Borders said Israeli troops fired tear gas several times into a hospital. Today, thousands are taking part in a funeral procession for the victims. Jenin's mayor lamented the UN has, quote, failed us, and accused Israel of war crimes. This is 63-year-old refugee in Jenin, Jihad Hassan.
This reminds me of the 1948 Nakba. People left their houses because of fear. Today also people left because of fear, but also because of the bombs which target civilians and others. The Israeli army doesn't differentiate between armed and unarmed. The difference in 2002 and today is the military machines. Today the military artillery is stronger and heavier. Now they use drones. Before they used Apache weapons. I was injured in 2002 by shrapnel from a rocket in my leg. But this time the military artillery is stronger and heavier.
Meanwhile, Israel launched airstrikes on Gaza earlier today in response to rocket fire from the besieged enclave. Days before raiding Jenin, the far-right Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his ultra-nationalist government announced Israel would buy 25 F-35 stealth fighter jets from the United States at the cost of $3 billion. In response to the raid, the White House defended what it called Israel's, quote, right to defend itself. Palestinian-American Congressmember Rashida Tlaib condemned the operation and said, quote, Congress must stop funding this violent Israeli apartheid regime, Tlaib said. All this comes amidst more than 450 attacks on Palestinians by settlers this year alone, and as thousands of Israelis protested Monday against Netanyahu's plans to overhaul and severely curtail the powers of the judiciary. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Haifa, Amjad Araki is a senior editor at 972 Magazine, where his latest piece is headlined in Jenin, Israel's Unveiling the Next Phase of Apartheid. And in Jenin, Mustafa Shittah is with us, the general manager of the Freedom Theater. He wrote a piece for Mondo Weiss titled, The Gravity of the Situation Cannot Be Understated, an Eyewitness Account from the Israeli Assault on Jenin. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Mustafa, let's begin with you. Inside the refugee camp, can you describe what took place over these last 2 days?
In fact, thank you for hosting me in this meeting. In fact, during the last 2 days, we faced really a horrible and difficult situation by this Israel big military attack of Jenin, which started by rocks that targeted the middle of Jenin refugee camp. We talk about 1 kilometer. They target the people, the refugees in Jenin refugee camp. They are around 15,000 persons. They are live there. And they target them, and until under this title, they came here to clean the yard, and they want to end the concept and the idea of resistance in Palestine in through Jenin refugee camp. It was a really difficult situation for the people where they are live in a hard condition, without electricity from the first time of this invasion, without water. They destroy the infrastructure of the Jenin refugee camp and in Jenin city, and they try to enter and to make a siege around the camp, to make it alone, and to put all the people under this attack from the first time. We consider that it's like a collective punishment against any person in Jenin, against everything, against the theater, against the trees, against the walls. They destroy the cars, they destroy the houses. It's like, as what I said, it's like collective punishment against the people already. They are stand and they support the resistance and they support the fighters in Jenin refugee camp. So it was really hard, really difficult for the children, for the women, for the old people, and including the normal people in Jenin in general.
And Mustafa Shetta, why has Jenin emerged in recent years as such a focus of Israeli repression and attacks What is particular about the Jenin camp that Israel is so concerned about?
We are live, in fact, in political area. I mean, all the people here, they are refugees. They have a political identity. They have issue until this moment, after 75 years, until this moment, it's not solved. They ask for right of return. They are live in an area, it's not for them. I mean, for the refugees. The idea, it started from, not just from 2002, it started from long time, from the first day of establishing the camp in 54. After that, the different resistance from the first intifada in 87, whereas the refugees that are involved for liberate Palestine. And in 2002, in the big invasion happened in Jenin, where Israel think by their using the hard power, when they attacked Jenin in big invasion happened in 2002 and killed the people. Talk about 53 persons already were killed in Jenin. They destroyed the core of Jenin refugee camp. They think they by that way, they end the idea or the way of thinking about resistance and revolution. But they don't know the new generation already. They are born in 2002. They are now lead this resistance in Jenin refugee camp. And by this way, it's not stopped here. I mean, all the time, why Jenin? Because we are still in the same feeling about injustice. And the people here, they think all the time they must be involved in this kind of resistance because they protect their dignity and their common identity about the concept of refugee, the concept of right of return, and liberate Palestine and end the occupation.
You're the general manager of the Freedom Theater. Could you talk about the significance of the work that you do and whether your theater was targeted as well?
In fact, the Freedom Theater, we are lucky because we have like a unique story. The idea of the Freedom Theater started with the Jewish woman, her name Arna Merchamis, when she came to Jenin during the first Intifada and established the childhood center in Jenin City and Jenin refugee camp. And that's why that to provide the space for the children to expression and talk about themselves. Later, Giuliano, her son, when he joined to her mother and they established together the Stone Theater in the middle of Jenin refugee camp, it was the first theater in Jenin. The idea of establish already theater here, it's about find a space just to talk about the story from Jenin and Jenin refugee camp and how we can put the people already they have like real story and important story about the Palestine case, about the Palestine question in the light. So after that, in 2002, during the invasion, the Stone Theater destroyed by Israel. And Giuliano himself, he made his film, an important film. It's called Arna Children. It's a talk about what's the core of this dispute and conflict and the occupation in Palestine. Later in 2006, when we have the Freedom Theater by Giuliano and Zakaria Zubaydi, when we have the theater again, we consider it's part of resistance. We raise the idea and the concept of cultural resistance here, where we provide space for create and raise the critical and brave voice here. That's important for our people, and this one of our impact work with our people, where we provide the space for the children they don't already, they have any yard or any space in this 1 kilometer to play, to game. We'll provide the space for the talent from the camp to come here to be like, not just to be a professional actor, to be like social leader, believe in freedom. And here we talk about the whole concept of freedom. Freedom in the incubation, freedom of thinking, freedom of choosing. All of that, we protect that and put it in our interest, in our focus, and our goals too. So we have this impact and they have this kind of relationship. The people in Jenin refugee camp, they consider the Freedom Theater is really important for them because already we have like this bridge between what the reality happened here and the international and the people outside of Palestine, because we are talk about Palestine through this creative language, through theater and the performing arts.
I want to also bring in, I'm Jad Iraqi, senior editor at 972 magazine. He's speaking to us from Haifa. Amjad, you have said the Jenin operation, the Jenin assault, is being carried out in the context of Israel's, quote, mowing the lawn doctrine as a means of maintaining its apartheid regime. Can you explain and talk about who exactly is behind it and the significance of the day before the attack, the U.S. approving more weapon sales to Israel, bringing their total of planes to what I think it was 75 attack planes?
Thank you, Amy, and to Democracy Now! For having me. So, in a nutshell, the idea of mowing the lawn is a doctrine that has been promoted by the Israeli military for quite a while and is mostly associated with Israeli army policy vis-a-vis the Gaza Strip, particularly targeting the political group Hamas and Islamic Jihad and other militants. And the idea of mowing the lawn or mowing the grass is essentially this idea that the Israelis have, that if there's no permanent solution to really eradicate these Palestinian militant groups, then the idea is that you're in a constant cycle to basically undercut their capacity temporarily until the next round. And this is what we've been seeing put in full force, especially since the beginning of the blockade of Gaza in 2007. Now, you've seen variations of this military policy practice in many respects, but what we've been seeing in the past few days in Jenin is that doctrine being played out in full force. I mean, this operation itself is not happening in a vacuum. For the past year and a half, the Israeli army has been focusing on cities like Jenin and Nablus in the northern West Bank, where it has been actively targeting Palestinian militants and their weapons. But of course, as Mustafa was describing, this has come at the complete collective punishment of the populations over there, especially the refugee camps, very much in the same kind of methodology as what we're seeing in the Gaza Strip. And as those confrontations have escalated between militants, both against the army and against settlements, and sometimes against cities inside Israel, that the army is coming under more and more pressure to actually go in as a ground invasion. And even 2 weeks ago, we saw, as you described, the first time that they returned to air power through Apache helicopters, which I believe are supplied by the United States, and then 2 days later through a drone strike. And basically, these being the first airstrikes in the West Bank for the first time since the Second Intifada, even though they've, of course, been very much the modus operandi in the Gaza Strip. So this is that manifestation that we're seeing. This is the philosophy that's playing out, basically as the maintenance of an apartheid regime that includes Gaza and the West Bank, and that this is the solution that the Israeli authorities are seeing from the political echelon to the military establishment.
And Amjad Iraqi, could you place what's been happening there over the last few weeks and months in the context of the most extreme right-wing government that Israel has had and in its history, and the decision of the new Netanyahu government to begin to accelerate more and more settlements in the West Bank? I think we may have lost the audio. Let's go back to Mustafa Shetta. Mustafa, your response to that same question, the decision by the Netanyahu government to begin once again to accelerate settler expansion on the West Bank, to what degree has this contributed to the rising tensions there?
I think Netanyahu, he and his government, in fact, they are really failed in what's happened in Jenin, and I think they want to send the important messages to their people. I think it's for the, like we can say it's like political benefit there. They try to say we are still strong, we are still can control after the military operations happened in Jenin and in West Bank. Before that, before 10 days, we are in the same condition for 2 years, in fact. And they are nothing changed. I mean, they are still continue to punish us, to attack us. And I think this kind of policies, it's not just help, not the Israeli people or not the government, and for sure not the Palestinian. They are still in the same condition, and without, we can say, not without any benefit for the for any person, any party. So I expect this government will fail and will maybe it will not continue. And the first day of this government established, I said, I don't expect there is something good will come with it. It will be worse and worse, especially for the Palestinian. I don't know if you heard about Netanyahu's statement and speech when he said he don't believe in two states now. We are too. We don't believe in two states in this condition. We are believing in one state. That state, it will be Palestine in the future. Because all this condition, it's like Israel itself now in this time.
Mustafa Shetta, as we wrap up, if you can respond to the possibility the Israeli government is saying that they will reserve the right to go back into Jenin to continue this assault, and also the significance of the thousands of people, Israelis, who were in the streets protesting. But they were protesting against Netanyahu dismantling the Israeli judiciary. Were there Israeli protests against the assault on the Jenin refugee camp where you are, Mustafa?
In fact, I expect Israel, they will return to Jenin maybe after 2 days, 2 weeks, or 1 month. We don't know. We know they don't achieve their goals until this moment. The protest in Israel, the demonstration in Israel against Netanyahu, it's not started from now. It's not just about what's going on in Jenin. They have a lot of interior problems, like with the Israeli law too. But